Well, hello. My name is Angelle Wood, and this is Crime of the Truest Kind. Well, here we go. Season number three. Hey, everybody. So I went to the True Crime Podcast Festival in Austin, Texas at the end of August. I had a great time. I met a lot of people in the true crime space. I came back energized and ready to rock and roll. While the show technically got its start at the end of 2020, the show's really 2 years old because of that unplanned long hiatus in the middle. So the show's 2 years old. Here we are, rolling into season three with all of my dogs are going to bark at the same time. Rolling into season three, Crime of the Truest Kind's advocacy and action in full effect. I went to the Massachusetts State House last week in Boston and sat in committee and listened to people testify about their experiences in asking for legislative change in regard to domestic violence, coercive control. There were folks testifying about their experience with child sexual abuse, really very serious things. And I have a lot planned. Some of you may have seen the new Facebook group that I've been sharing, Who Killed Karina Homer, a case that I covered in the summer of 2021. Well, there are plans to advocate for unsolved crimes. And I know this is a lot of talking up front, which I try to avoid. But I have a few things to cover, like our first live crime event. It's happening Thursday, November 9th, off Cabot, Beverly, Massachusetts. It'll be part meet and greet, part wine tasting. My lovely friend Diane is pairing some wines for us. Cocktails, mocktails. Some true crime trivia with prizes, and a live case discussion that we will record for Crime of the Truest Kind. And I have a special guest planned. Tickets are available for the show. Follow Crime of the Truest Kind everywhere. This is a true crime, local history, and storytelling podcast. I write about crimes, yes. I set the scene, I connect story themes. I talk about the things that happened here in Massachusetts and New England. This episode is about a murdered child, drugs, gang violence, witness intimidation, police misconduct, wrongful convictions, and a still unsolved crime. We head to the Boston neighborhood of Roxbury in the murder of 12-year-old Darlene Tiffany Moore. There is so much to talk about in this case. This will be part one of two. Episode 48, Tiffany Moore, Roxbury, Massachusetts. Boston has its many colleges and universities. It is a revolving door of fresh-faced students and many bedbugs. But it is a city of neighborhoods. Boston's a big, small town. That might only make sense to some of you. The city of Boston is represented by 22 neighborhoods, or districts. Some were cities and towns on their own that were later annexed to Boston. Roxbury is one of those neighborhoods. Roxbury has Franklin Park and its famed zoo, the hub of Nubian Square, the Shirley Eustace House, and the Victorian Gothic mansion that is home to the National Center of Afro-American Artists. Today, Roxbury is the heart of Black culture in Boston, and the area is in the midst of its own renaissance. New business and housing initiatives are renewing Roxbury's main districts, including Dudley Square, aka Nubian Square, Crosstown, and Grove Hall. In a piece in Boston Magazine by Megan Johnson, a series about living in the Boston districts they call So You Want to Live in Roxbury. Megan writes this: ask any longtime resident and they'll tell you the one word that embodies Roxbury: community. In the 1600s, Roxbury, R-O-C-K-S-B-E-R-R-Y, was named for its rocky soil. It was highly attractive to colonists thanks to its abundant natural resources. Later, the neighborhood became known for its Irish population, large Latvian community, as well as its Jewish community near Grove Hall. The neighborhood's Black community began to develop in the early 1900s. By the mid-20th century, Roxbury became the epicenter of Boston's Black culture. Nubian Square, formerly Dudley Square, served as its hub, and soon, movie theaters, hotels, and department stores were built there. If you speak to people who grew up in Roxbury, their love of the neighborhood is palpable. Current and former residents will say they felt it was an immense privilege to grow up there. And they look back on the days when you could hit up Frankie Fresh Records or listen to Wild on the radio before checking out a neighborhood talent show. They recall music producer Maurice Starr, who discovered Roxbury's own New Edition, as well as the New Kids. He would roll up in his drop-top Mercedes, handing out dollars to the neighborhood kids. Residents have the same level of pride for their thriving arts and music community as they did for Shaky, a local man known for hanging around the neighborhood. He has since been immortalized on t-shirts that read, "I grew up in Roxbury," on the back. While there's been significant spillover of college students from Mission Hill and the Fenway in recent years, Roxbury has become increasingly popular with young professionals and families who are attracted to the neighborhood's diversity, exquisite array of architectural history, and price tags slightly less painful than in other areas of the city. Roxbury is filled with lush community gardens, bustling green spaces like Malcolm X Park, where summer basketball tournaments are veritable family reunions, and Highland Park with its landmark Fort Hill Tower, surrounded by weeping willow trees. While many fear that gentrification will eliminate the charm and the diversity that Roxbury is known for, newer residents say that, hands down, they've never lived anywhere friendlier. That is in Boston Magazine. And I didn't read any other neighborhood pieces, but like all of the neighborhoods, people who grew up there are being priced out. In Somerville, for example, right now in Union Square, one of the last places in that city to become a sought-after place to move, the noobs in the new condos have already started to complain about the noise from local businesses that have existed for decades. Sally O'Brien's on Somerville Ave has to stop live music at 11 p.m. thanks to all the new folks complaining. That's like moving to the Fenway and being mad that people show up for baseball. But that's happening in the city with all the bougie people moving in. Roxbury is home to familiar names and many great artists. James Curley, former Boston mayor, born in Roxbury. Gladys Sarah Wood, educator and the first African-American principal in Boston public schools. Louis Eugene Walcott grew up in Roxbury. He would later change his name to Farrakhan when he converted to Islam. Malcolm X lived in Roxbury as a teenager in the early 1940s. And that house on Dale Street has been added to the National Register of Historic Places. New Edition, born in Roxbury, with locals Ricky Bell, Michael Bivins, Bobby Brown, Ronnie DeVoe, and Ralph Tresvant. I have Candy Girl in my head right now. Guru from Gangstar, rest in peace, Guru. Roy Haynes, the award-winning drummer who played with Miles Davis and Sarah Vaughan and Charlie Parker and Thelonious Monk and Ray Charles and Chick Corea and Pat Metheny, you get it? And Roy is still with us at 98. Ed OG, OG rapper. Safe to say, Boston's foremost hip-hop artist. Actress Diane Guerrero grew up in Roxbury. Fans of Orange is the New Black will remember her as inmate Maritza Ramos. I'll come back to you now. A multi-award-winning hip-hop artist, Oompa, also from Roxbury. Friday, August 19th, 1988. It was a cooler day, a welcome relief from the soaring temperatures the city had been suffering through. That summer day was in the low 70s. The city had been in the grips of a heat wave that reached a high of 96 just a few days earlier. The city is hot, and it's crowded. The heat adds to the regular city frustrations. It intensifies the fragrant body odor, the trash, the cooking smells that waft down hallways and through apartment buildings. You cannot forget the smell of the subway in the summer. Like it's melting with the weight of the bodies that they slowly distribute to and from their destinations. I remember one particularly sad summer. I had to ride the Orange Line to Charlestown, grab the ferry across the harbor to make my way to the Red Line to Cambridge. I did have a car, but that summer I was too broke to get it repaired right away. So I took buses to subways to ferries to subways. It took twice, maybe even three times as long. It's the way of the city dweller, and I was lucky I had the option. I remember I was living in Malden, working in Charlestown, and in Cambridge. Don't think I was working at the station in Lynn yet. I'm pretty sure I was right out of college, and I had a lot of jobs. Boston is typically quieter, well, less crowded during the summer months with the students gone. That Friday night at 9:22, a call came into Boston police. A woman was yelling into the phone to the 911 operator. "There's a little girl shot on Humboldt Ave." That little girl was just sitting on a mailbox, and within seconds, that little girl would be on the ground bleeding. She was just talking with friends until bullets hit her, one to the head, which made her incompatible with life. Darlene Tiffany Moore was 12 years old, and despite many of the articles written at the time of her death saying she was 11, Tiffany, as she was known, was born on November 18th, 1975, and died on August 19th, 1988, 3 months shy of her 13th birthday. Tiffany was the victim of street violence. I stop at saying the unintended victim because when you ambush a group of people with a loaded gun with the intent to shoot someone, you have intended some victims. Now, being in the inner city, a phrase that is often code for areas with socioeconomic problems, that made the violence of her murder no less traumatic or horrifying or infuriating for the people of Roxbury. What made her death even sadder is that she had only been visiting that summer. She'd been here for 2 weeks. Tiffany was going back to Greenville, South Carolina 2 days later to get ready to start seventh grade at Lakeview Middle School when she was killed. She moved there to live with her aunt 2 years earlier to escape exactly what would take her life. Her sister Audrey told the Boston Globe that Tiffany had no desire to return to Boston permanently. She was up visiting her mom Alice and her older brother Daryl. Greenville, where her mom had moved from 17 years earlier, was where Tiffany preferred to be. Tiffany's mother, Alice Moore, spoke to the New York Times after her daughter's murder. She shared that she sent Tiffany away because she did not want her children brought up in a community with a whole lot of riffraff. That's a quote. Her 14-year-old son, Daryl, was in Virginia, and Audrey, who was 19 when Tiffany was killed, was also living in South Carolina. Tiffany liked its quiet and its friendliness. It was calmer. She chose that over the crowded chaos of the city. She was described as friendly and loving, a sweet child who was respectful and polite, and in no way would have put herself in the middle of trouble. It was why she left. It was what she left. She was making her way as an honor student, playing trombone in her school band, learning organ and piano. Tiffany was also a member of the Just Say No program. Those three words were first used by the then First Lady Nancy Reagan in 1982 in response to a student who wanted to know what to do if they were offered drugs. Just Say No would become a movement among school-age kids and a catchphrase, especially with teenagers and young adults. In many ways, it seemed simplistic and absurd. When President Reagan took office in 1981, he vowed to reprioritize this war on drugs that first began when President Nixon made the declaration 10 years earlier. Even though drug use was on the decline in the early 80s, he made it his top priority. U.S. cities would soon be mired in the crack epidemic, the more addictive form of cocaine. Users smoke a concentrated rock form and it goes to the bloodstream immediately for a much faster high. I've never done crack, thankfully, but I have seen Requiem for a Dream. Yeah, that's about heroin, but it is grim as fuck. Crack devastated communities of color. Crime rates rose and incarceration rates soared. The crack epidemic and the AIDS crisis were hallmarks of the Reagan presidency. There were more, but I remember those from history lessons. We watched the social, cultural, and political conflicts of this time. Some even said this so-called war on drugs was actually a political spectacle that advanced an agenda of religious groups to dismiss social problems that were grounded in economic devastation as individual moral problems that could simply be remedied by just saying no. So essentially blaming people for their own poverty and addiction. In 1986, Reagan signed the Anti-Drug Abuse Act. This law allotted $1.7 billion to continue fighting this war on drugs that his administration was so hyper-focused on. It became the one constant issue that Reagan would bring up in cabinet meetings. Casper Weinberger, what are you doing for the war on drugs? Like, what are you bringing to the bake sale? Definitely non-hash brownies. The Anti-Drug Abuse Act established mandatory minimum prison sentences for specific drug offenses. And that trend continued. The Vera Institute for Justice says the number of people incarcerated for nonviolent drug offenses increased from 50,000 in 1980 to more than 400,000 by 1997. Then there was the DARE program, an acronym for Drug Abuse Resistance Education. Known in certain circles as drugs are really excellent. If you were a kid who went to a public school in America in the 80s, then you knew exactly what I mean. DARE was developed in 1983 as a joint effort between Los Angeles County School District and the Los Angeles Police Department. In 1986, Congress passed the Drug-Free Schools and Communities Act. It was to promote drug abuse education and prevention programs. Many school districts around the country signed on to the DARE program. It was initially designed for 5th and 6th graders specifically. Is that when they think kids start smoking weed? Because if you had an older sibling, you already smoked up. I seem to remember there was like a vagueness about it, and this did come up in my research too. It was like everything was on the same level, like beer and cigarettes and like angel dust. I guess some education is better than no education, unless it's miseducation. And, well, no one knew what vaping was in 1988. Studies were done to show that simply telling anyone to just say no won't produce lasting effects because many lack the needed interpersonal skills. I'm not entirely sure what that has to do with it. It gave us zero tolerance policies and drug-free zones, cops in schools and stop and frisk. We didn't get a PC principal, though. All while cities spent $400,000 on public toilets designed to discourage drug use. I'm trying to think what that would look like. Oh, so nothing to chop lines on? I get it. It is all pretty meaningless in light of the epidemic of prescription drug abuse, where people are prescribed medicine that actually made them addicted. When OxyContin entered the market in 1996, the FDA approved its original label, which said addiction was very rare, which is a big fat fucking lie. Watch any Sackler doc and you'll see. According to the National Institute on Drug Abuse, opioid-involved overdose deaths have risen sharply. Here are some recorded figures, for example. There were 21,089 in 2010, 47,600 in 2017, with a significant increase in 2020, with 68,630 reported deaths, and again in 2021, 80,411 reported overdose deaths. That is not going down. As more people were dying of opiates in different parts of the country, in different neighborhoods, in different demographics, with different kinds of socioeconomic situations, people started to look at things differently. Tiffany Moore was killed by gang members, or someone had it out for a drug dealer. Imagine how commerce has changed today. Tiffany had gotten away from the violence that was permeating the neighborhoods of Boston, something that was not uncommon for kids who had options. I went to junior high in New Hampshire with a girl who moved in with a relative there after someone had set her hair on fire at school. Now, Nashua was a far cry from the mean streets of Dorchester. The worst that happened in Nashua was probably that someone may borrow a pair of your shoes and not return them to you. Torching your hair, that would be a good reason to leave. Her name was Kelly, and I totally rabbit-holed looking for them on the internet, and I'm pretty sure I found them online. Tiffany's death did shine the spotlight on the scourge of violent crime in Boston's neighborhoods. It would also show the lengths law enforcement would go to end public pressure. Tiffany's shooting was covered by the local media and picked up by the national press. She became the unwitting poster child for the epidemic of gang violence at the time. Her murder prompted local groups to mobilize and advocate to address street violence. Some Roxbury neighborhoods had become open battlegrounds for warring factions. That summer had seen an increase in gang activity. That's what James Jordan, Boston police spokesman, told the Boston Globe, that more kids were firing at each other on the city streets than ever before. And two teenagers, Reggie Ballard, 17, and 14-year-old Nigel Austin, were both shot in the head in broad daylight on Ruggles Street in Roxbury. Nigel Austin survived, but Reggie Ballard died that night. Stories like that one and like Tiffany's forced the community to act and get the city to mobilize. The then mayor, Ray Flynn, announced that Boston police reassigned 40 officers to patrol Roxbury on foot and to break up groups of people in areas where drug dealers were known to congregate. Boston had an extraordinarily high level of racial tensions in the 1970s. We could never do enough to undo the damage the busing crisis did to the people and the reputation of the city of Boston. In 1974, in response to decades of racial segregation, the U.S. District Court of the District of Massachusetts required the Boston Public Schools to integrate the city's schools through busing. Court-mandated busing continued until 1988 and elicited outrage among many white Bostonians. It is largely responsible for racist violence and class tensions throughout the 70s and 80s. Anti-busing protests became national news in those years. It cemented Boston's reputation as a city plagued by racial and socioeconomic strife. Adults throwing rocks at children trying to go to school, being forced out of their neighborhoods, well, that's a scar that will never heal. And what I mean by that, it is a documented part of our history, and it is brutal. Serving as mayor of Boston from 1984 until 1993, Ray Flynn worked to put the fierce divisions of school desegregation behind Boston. Then, he left to become ambassador to the United States of the Holy See. The what? The ambassador to the Vatican. Yep. Boston Mayor Ray Flynn was appointed to the Holy City by President Clinton in 1993. He would be succeeded by Mayor Thomas Menino, the longest-serving mayor in Boston's history, from 1993 to 2014. He did not run for another term due to his failing health. but he would have handily won. Mayor Menino was succeeded by Mayor Marty Walsh, who then left to be Labor Secretary under President Biden. Mayor Flynn met with the members of the community who were furious about Tiffany's murder. They wanted action. The mayor told them that the two-person patrols he put in place on a permanent basis will concentrate on Homestead Street, with the purpose of keeping traffic flowing there and on other neighborhood streets. Police officers were brought in from other units throughout the city. Tiffany Moore's murder was having a major impact on the city. Her murder took place in August 1988. A year later, the city would be on edge and making national news again when Carol DeMady Stewart was shot in her car while leaving a birthing class. I cover the DeMady Stewart case in episode number 5. Go back and listen. About that, I say this. On the evening of October 23rd, 1989, Boston was rocked by one of the most notorious and damaging crimes in the city's history, the murder of Carol DeMady Stewart. She was 7.5 months pregnant with her first baby. She was murdered after leaving a birthing class at Brigham and Women's Hospital. The case was highly publicized, emotionally charged, and sensationalized by Boston media and outlets across the country. Scenes from the crime were captured on an early version of reality television. It scarred the city for life. The police tore through Boston neighborhoods looking for a black man with a raspy voice wearing a black tracksuit. That man they were looking for did not exist. It was all a hoax. And Marky Mark wrote a song about it. Charles Stewart made up that a black man ambushed his family and murdered his wife and son. He would be found out, and then he jumped from the Tobin Bridge in early January 1990. Now, Marky Mark, who has his own violent past that I need to research further, sang the song. With a verse about Charles Stewart's crime hoax and Tiffany Moore's murder on Wildside. It and most of the songs on Music for the People were co-written by MC Spice the Legend, also from Roxbury, and also Donnie Wahlberg, New Kid on the Block. Wildside was the follow-up to their hit Good Vibrations, which I won't play. It made it to number 10 on the charts in the U.S. with a sample of Lou Reed's classic song. His fans hated it naturally. Music for the People was released on July 23, 1991, to mixed reviews, but still managed to go platinum with 1 million sold. It's also very Boston of me to include this to make fun of Marky Mark. And now he's in all the movies, saving all the days, and capturing all the bad guys, including marathon bombers. Tiffany was caught in the crosshairs of despair and survival that has ruled the streets. Residents of her Roxbury neighborhood called for a curfew and the National Guard to patrol the streets. The mayor and the police commissioner pledged a prompt response. Given the amount of pressure from the community, the cops wanted them to believe that they set out to combat the plague of drugs, the supply and demand in Boston neighborhoods, especially in the region of what's called Area B, which covers Roxbury, Mattapan, and sections of Dorchester. Boston police planned to deploy 40 police officers, including the Drug Enforcement Unit, to patrol the Homestead Street area where she was shot. They needed to make an attempt to stifle the drug trade. The response was lukewarm from residents and other officers. The question would remain, though, who took the life of this promising little girl and cast the glare of light on the brutality of the city streets where children weren't safe to sit outside? They needed an arrest, and they needed it fast. On that August night, armed men wearing Halloween masks came upon a crowd of people on that Roxbury street. The news reported it as the intended target was a rival gang member. The masked men fired shots into the crowd. Tiffany was hit. Everybody panicked. The shooters ran. two men would emerge as suspects. Sean Drumgold from Roxbury, Terrence Taylor of Dorchester, both 23, were identified by someone in the area who told police they were seen carrying guns several blocks away from the crime scene. 10 days after Tiffany was murdered, an arrest was made and a wave of relief swept across the city. That weekend, Sean Drumgold was arrested for heroin possession. He had also failed to show up that Friday, a week after Tiffany's murder, for a pre-arranged meeting with homicide detectives. Witness statements taken the night of Tiffany's murder ID Drumgold as one of two masked men who ran up on a group of about 15 kids and started shooting. It was initially believed that the shooters were targeting some kids or young men who were associates of rival dealers from Humboldt Avenue and Castlegate Road. They called themselves the Humboldt Boys and the Castlegate Raiders. I will say this, though. I will forever be curious as to who gets to name the gang. The working theory here was that the shooters were after revenge, possibly for a ripoff that occurred the week before, or the recent stabbing of a Castlegate by some Humboldts. Drumgold got on their radar early, and they were looking for him for questioning. With the help of his mother, police spoke to Sean over the phone, and he agreed to meet. But he was a no-show when the time came. Homicide detectives were after him all weekend. What they didn't know was that Drumgold had been picked up at the Orchard Park housing project in the early morning hours of that Sunday. He was already locked up on drug charges. He gave police the name David Royston, and then he was charged with possession of 26 packets of heroin with intent to distribute. Drumgold was known to the cops, and he was known to use aliases, and he was known to use David Royston. When homicide detectives Richard Walsh and Paul Murphy went to the Suffolk County DA's office to get the arrest warrant charging Sean Drumgold with Tiffany's murder, they learn from somebody there that he uses that alias. So Sean Drumgold, aka David Royston, was already in custody. That had to make things a little easier. The then police commissioner, Francis Mickey Roach, who is from Southie, if the nickname didn't give it away. The commissioner called a news conference to praise the investigators and the Roxbury community, which he said was instrumental in helping make the arrest. Back down to earth, though, people with knowledge of the investigation said that cooperation was limited. In the identification of a second suspect, that's a bit dicey. Meanwhile, the commissioner is going on and on about a job well done. Oh, and the ID of the first suspect? Well, that'll prove to be problematic, and we will get to that. The commissioner announced arrests in Tiffany's case and in another child murder, that of 16-year-old Richard Bailey, known as Poyo, the weekend after Tiffany was shot. He was stabbed outside the Warren Gardens housing complex after getting into a fistfight with another boy the night before. He reportedly ID'd 18-year-old Emmett Snow before he died from his injuries. Snow was charged with second-degree murder. Richard Bailey's death was not tied to Tiffany's. Warren Gardens is quite a walk from the H block where Tiffany was. And Commissioner Roach declared arrests in practically every vicious felony, that's a quote, that had the media's attention that summer. He also used the opportunity to scold the community a little bit. He said that it's too easy to expect police to be the solution for violence. And even with the largest police forces, courts must be tougher and more prisons must be built. Roach insisted that the city's 1,900-member police force was enough and that deployment of the National Guard was unnecessary. On that Monday morning, Sean Drumgold appeared for his arraignment on the charge of murder in the death of Tiffany Moore. He had a black jacket draped over his head to shield his face from photographers. This while his wife and baby daughter sat watching in the courtroom. The judge in the case set bail at $250,000, This came after hearing John Canavan from the Suffolk County DA's office deliver a list of wrongdoings and past crimes, including a 1985 drug and weapons offense. That sent Sean Drumgold to jail for almost a year. Suspect 2, Terrence Taylor, would be arrested in a matter of days, and then the two men would face the fight of their lives. First-degree murder charges in the death of Tiffany Moore. Her murder grew to symbolize lawlessness on the streets of Boston neighborhoods. Activists used her death to emphasize how little the city was doing to address crime and poverty in mostly minority neighborhoods. Supporters of Sean Drumgold, his family, his attorney, they saw his arrest as law enforcement bowing to public pressure. His mother, Wanda Drumgold, who lived one block from where Tiffany was killed, she said her son was being railroaded. Well, that's a whole other can of worms, my friends. That concludes part 1 of 2. Tiffany Moore, Roxbury, Massachusetts. How a child's death impacted an entire city. Thank you for listening. In part 2, we will walk through the trial of Sean Drumgold and what happens after. My name is Angele Wood. This is Crime of the Truest Kind. You can support the show. You can share on your social media channels. Tell your friends who like true crime and history and New England stories. You can go to Apple Podcasts and leave a 5-star review. Tell me what you like about the show. Tell me how you learned about it. Tell me where you live. I will share it on an upcoming episode. Drop a tip in the jar. Give the dogs a bone. Become a patron. 4 tiers, beginning with $1. Patreon.com/crimeofthetruestkind. It is linked at crimeofthetruestkind.com. Thank you to patrons Lisa, Deborah, Dominique, Mark, Rebecca, Devil Dog. I have some fun plans for patrons we'll be building on the Patreon platform coming up. I will share everything at crimeofthetruestkind.com. Listen everywhere you get podcasts. I also share the show on YouTube. Thank you for listening. Yes, lock your goddamn doors.